But we get things underway this afternoon by welcoming to the program a journalist who has just wrapped up work on a brand new book along with the legendary Bill Zamy, and it is the most thorough look at the king of late night television. The book is called Carson the Magnificent. We're so happy to be joined by Mike Thomas. Mike, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hey, Rich. Thank you for having me on.
Man, the book is so great, and as someone who has been fascinated with Carson since I was a kid, I was thinking about it. Certainly, nobody will ever do what he did. The landscape of broadcasting has changed so much since he left the air back in 92. But when you think about the icons of television, whether it's Lucille Ball or Milton Berle, was there anybody bigger than Carson?
I don't think so. I think Carson was the biggest television star who ever lived. And I know that's saying a lot, but, you know, he was on for three decades and at the top of the ratings for many of those years. In fact, the great Bill Carter, who wrote all about the late night wars, just basically said the same thing. Carson was the biggest television star ever. Totally agree with that.
Well, he's got such an interesting story. He got his start doing magic. That was the gateway to the world of entertainment. But is it safe to say that over the course of his professional career, he embraced the magician's ideal of keeping secrets?
He did. I mean, Carson was, a master at basically hiding in plain sight. He was not the man he was on stage in life. He was far more introverted. He could be more emotional, you know, sadder, angrier. But he was the coolest cat in the world on stage. And he would reveal himself, but only in dribs and drabs, little bits and pieces. And that's part of what Bill did in researching this book is go through every single Tonight Show transcript. He had access to all of the material and mine all of these personal details that Johnny would reveal either in his monologues or in his conversations with his guests.
Well, the story of the book is a fascinating one as well. Your relationship with Bill dates back to what, 1995?
Yeah, a little after, probably 96. I was a mid-20s wannabe magazine journalist, you know, trying to make his way in journalism. I had just moved to Chicago. I was working for a trade magazine. I had been reading Bill's work for years in Rolling Stone and Esquire. And I was reading this free weekly one night while I was, you know, taking IDs at my cousin's bar. And it said, Bill Zamy has moved back to Chicago. I didn't know he was from Chicago. And he landed the contract to do Jay Leno's memoir. And, you know, back in those days, I would try to pick people's brains who were way better than I was at what they were doing. And I was like, wow, maybe I can pick Bill's brain. So I wrote him a letter, dropped him some of my freelance clips. And I was surprised he called me. And we met up, and it turned out he needed some help with Jay, which led to a Sinatra book, and then an Andy Kaufman book, and then a Regis book. So I worked with him for 3.5 years before I set off to the Chicago Sun-Times.
And you explain in the book that you became what's called in the parlance of the industry his leg man.
Yes, I did a lot of interviews, a lot of research. He taught me how to make books. And, you know, we made three of them during the course of our work together. I didn't do all that much on Leno, but certainly Sinatra, Kaufman, and Regis. You know, he taught me how to structure them, how to research more about reporting, how to have conversations with people rather than interrogate them. So it was basically a paid internship because I was his full-time researcher for all that time.
Well, the book, nearly 25 years in the works. It began back in the early 2000s, and he was able to land that rare, and again, not really interview, but conversation with Carson that opened the doors to the project. And then, of course, a decade-long battle with colorectal cancer. How did you get involved in the project and in completing the work that Bill had begun?
Well, I was, of course, extremely sad after he died, and I had no idea that this Carson project he had carried for so long could live anymore after Bill was gone. But about 3 months after he died, I got a call from his longtime editor, Jonathan Karp, who's now the head of Simon & Schuster. But John had acquired the book at Random House way back when, 20 years ago almost. It's amazing to realize. And, you know, I put John in touch with Bill's daughter, and then John got back to me and said, well, how about finishing the book? What do you think? And I said, John, it's flattering, but I don't know how much Bill has completed research-wise, reporting-wise. I had never read the manuscript that he had finished, which turned out to be about three-quarters of the book. And so I read that. I went through his piles of research just to make sure he had what I need to complete Johnny's story, and there was more than enough there. So at that point, I said I would be honored to take on this project.
Well, so many people were interviewed for the book, and so many stories. One of the quotes that stands out to me came from his longtime TV sidekick, Ed McMahon, who said, "Johnny packs a tight suitcase."
Yes, only takes with him what he needs. You know, he was a minimalist in that regard, whether it was, you know, materially, emotionally, all that stuff. But that line followed him around forever. And in fact, I think Johnny asked Ed what it meant at some point. Ed had to explain it to him. I think it appeared in the 1960s at some point. So yeah, he definitely packed a tight suitcase.
I grew up in Nebraska and had that Midwestern attitude and mannerism and approach on TV, which allowed him, I think, to maintain that sort of detachment that's essential in what we refer to as a cool medium. A lot of that has to come from his upbringing, what was certainly a fairly fraught relationship with his mother.
Yeah, I don't know if maybe the emotional coolness came in part from that. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but certainly it was a fraught relationship, but yeah, he was a cool guy in a cool medium. He was perfect for television and perfect for that format of television. And, you know, when he came up, it was the early 50s when he started his rise in radio and television. So it was this medium that was untested yet. And he ended up reinventing the whole late night, format, taking it over from Jack Parr, who was more emotional, but in a different way, and, didn't have Johnny's sense of humor or Johnny's sense of play or Johnny's sense of curiosity. All of that played into Carson's ability to connect with his audiences as well as his guests.
And I didn't realize what a big break he had received from Red Skelton on fairly short notice.
Yeah, I mean, Red Skelton had, wrenched his back, if I recall correctly, and he couldn't do a show one night, and Carson was called in on short notice and took over. I mean, Red had been listening to Johnny on the airwaves. He had been doing, Carson's Cellar, these shows in Los Angeles, and this, five-minute show called Carson's Coffee Break that Skelton actually made some appearances on. These were 1950s shows that didn't last long, but Red Skelton knew, this kid's going.
Well, and he had success as a game show host with Who Do You Trust? That led to the Tonight Show gig. But because of his contractual obligations, there was quite a waiting period after he was announced as the host before he could take over in October of 62.
There was, and he was growing antsy watching this cavalcade of hosts step in before he could actually step in. And, he was actually quite nervous. And his wife talks, his second wife, Joanne, talks about that a bit. Like, pacing around, walking around the city, worrying if he was going to be okay, if he was ready. So as cool as he was on the air, Johnny was anxious before that first show hit.
And we're talking with Mike Thomas about the new book, Carson the Magnificent. He borrowed some things from Steve Allen and others along the way, but it seems like it was always a work in progress with him. He didn't like to plan too far ahead and wanted to maintain some level of spontaneity.
He did. I think that's part of his brilliance, too. Nothing was too scripted. You saw that, to an amazing degree when he would try to worm his way out of jokes. His improvisational skills were very good, whether it was in a conversation or whether he felt he was bombing on stage. He didn't do it purposely, but people loved to watch him get out because they never knew what his reactions were going to be. It was either a facial expression or some utterance. But he was very good at that spur-of-the-moment stuff.
Did he like the limelight, the acclaim, even though he seemed to be a shy man and certainly someone who would recede to the background at a party, but did he like the recognition of being the king of late night?
I think he liked the recognition, but of course he'd rather play to a million people than be at a cocktail party with six people. He was he was that kind of guy, uncomfortable with small talk and in settings like that. But like many performers, far more comfortable on stage doing the show. The show was his life, and he would say that too. It kind of wrecked marriages. It ruined relationships with his kids, which could have been stronger. And he said that more times than once throughout his career. The Tonight Show was his everything. It was his most significant other.
Well, and I think the most poignant story in the book, when it comes to that, involves the aftermath of the death of his son Rick.
Yeah, he was, you know, and the timing of that was extremely tragic. On top of the extreme tragedy to begin with, it was just, Johnny's going into the final year of his show, and he finds out Rick has died in a car accident in the summer of 1991, and as he's gearing up to do this, you know, this ultimate last year. This veil of darkness descends. And even though he didn't have a strong relationship with his son, you can see the love he had for Rick, certainly, because Rick was the most like him, sort of sensibility-wise, sense of humor-wise. And Carson would grieve to the end of his life. But, on a show after Carson came back after a few weeks, after Rick's death, he did a five-minute eulogy at the end of the show. And it was really heartfelt. Johnny didn't do that kind of stuff on the air. He didn't bare his soul, wear his heart on his sleeve. But he certainly did that night without being maudlin about it. That was his word. He gave this amazing tribute to Rick.
Well, as cool as he could be on television, in his personal life, he could run very hot, certainly could be mean, could be violent, and didn't handle alcohol well in a number of ways.
No, he didn't, and I don't think that's any big revelation about Johnny. He really couldn't handle his liquor, and he admitted that. It didn't take that much, a couple of vodkas, you know, and it was kind of a Jekyll Hyde thing, but yes. It could get very, very tumultuous with his wives at home. Sometimes when he was in public, he would act up if he had too much to drink, and people would have to calm him down or usher him out of the room. I get the sense that he tempered it in later years. He was drinking wine toward the end, so maybe getting off the hard stuff helped. But certainly it flipped the switch in him.
In the book, you write about the fact, I think as early as around the 10th anniversary of his tenure as host, he was already talking about getting done fairly soon. He couldn't see himself doing it for 15 years or 20 years. What kept him on the job for 30 years?
I have to think he couldn't imagine himself without it quite yet, until he could. You know, he would say that stuff all the time as the run progressed in the 70s, in the 80s. He would say, I don't know how much longer I have. Can't imagine I'll be here for another year, maybe another five. I can't imagine another decade. And then, of course, you know, he keeps going and going. I'm sure it didn't hurt. He never said this that I know of. I'm sure it didn't hurt that the contracts became much more lucrative as the years went on. Johnny got far more vacation. He got nearly 4 months of vacation because they had guest hosts and reruns. So he kind of got to have his cake and eat it, too, at the end. He was making, almost 20% of NBC's profits were from The Tonight Show. So he was truly the king, at that network. And they literally couldn't afford to let him go, and they made it worth his while.
Certainly from the late 60s through the 70s and probably into the early 80s, he was the arbiter of taste in America. His commentaries in the monologue became water cooler conversations the next day. If you were a comedian who got the okay sign, or better yet, the invite over to the desk, then your career was made. But even he seemed to be aware that by the late 80s and early 90s, he was not that guy. He was not the center of the culture anymore.
No, he was not. I mean, of course, Letterman had been around since 82 and was becoming increasingly popular. But Johnny had co-ownership of that slot, so he was also profiting from Dave's success. And Dave was, you know, his mentee, essentially. But then you had Arsenio Hall coming up, and sort of Arsenio's thing was he wanted to get the kids of the people who had been watching Carson. I don't get the sense that it was, you know, an extremely ferocious rivalry, but certainly when the billboards started going up on sunset of Arsenio Hall, and he began getting all this ink in the New York Times and elsewhere. That put some pressure on Johnny, and I think it's only natural after nearly three decades that you're not the center of the universe anymore.
And he did not take too kindly to the skits on his own network when Saturday Night Live would poke fun at him.
Yeah, I guess there was one in particular that Dana Carvey and Phil Hartman used to do these Tonight Show sketches written by the great Robert Smigel. And, they would, Dana, as is his brilliant genius, would play Johnny as this exaggerated sort of caricature, and Phil would play it the same way. But there was one show that made Johnny seem kind of senile. He's talking to Susan Day, who's the guest host from the Partridge Family, and he's asking her about the show and how's David Cassidy and all these things, as if the Partridge Family is still on the air. And here it's the 1990s. And yeah, Johnny didn't take too kindly to that. So, he was not the happiest cat about those things.
Outside the memorial, the tribute to his son, Rick, was his final show without guests as close as he came to letting down his guard on television?
It certainly looks that way. Now, Bill Zamy was there in the audience.
Right, right.
And he somehow got a ticket. I don't know if it was through Doc Severinsen's publicist who got him backstage in the months before the show ended, or some way else. But Bill likened it to a religious experience, almost like being at church. And yes, I have to say, I think Johnny felt more protected because it was an all VIP audience. He knew it was going out over the airwaves, but he also knew this was the last time he was ever going to do this show on that stage. And so he did bare his soul, it appears to me, and I'm sure others, more on that episode than he ever had throughout the history of the show.
And he hinted in that final address to the audience that when he found something that that he was excited about, that he thought the audience would like, he would come back. And of course, he never did. I wonder, do you think the fact that he didn't come back cement his legacy even more?
I think so, too. Go out on top. It's the Seinfeld rule. Seinfeld always said he wanted to, he wanted to go out before the show started really tanking in the ratings. And as a result, look at its afterlife. But Carson was the same way. And I just think he had nothing left to prove. And he knew it. There were some rumblings about maybe a comeback special. Couple of his writers, including his monologue writer Mike Berry, drafted Johnny's 1994 comeback special for NBC, but it never got past the draft stage. There's actually an interesting part in the book. I had Mike kind of dissect what the show was and what Johnny liked and didn't like about it. But in the end, he just didn't think it was worth it. He had done all he needed to do, and he wasn't going to come back.
I think the tabloids like to portray this image of Carson in retirement as this lonely man on his boat with no purpose in life. But I got the impression from the conversation that Bill had with him, but also from the research that you both did in the book, that was not quite the case. He traveled. He learned to speak Swahili. It's not like he was sitting around watching reruns of The Tonight Show.
No, he was not. I think Johnny loved retirement. At least that's the way it seemed. He was on his yachts all the time. He was playing poker with his pals, Carl Reiner and Steve Martin and Neil Simon and all the rest. He was eating out at restaurants. He was going to movies. He was playing tennis. He was reading voraciously. So you get the sense the man really knew how to enjoy his downtime. I mean, toward the end, he became more isolated when his health started failing. But in those first years of retirement, no, I don't get the sense at all that
So after reading all of Bill's notes, the research that you did, and putting it all together in this wonderful book, do you feel like you know Carson a little bit better?
I feel like I know Carson a lot better. I mean, when I came to this book, I knew bits and pieces about Carson's personal life just from stuff I'd read here and there, and I knew about Carson the entertainer, and I appreciated his place in the late night and comedy firmament, certainly. And Bill and I would discuss him on and off, nothing in depth, but I didn't know much about Johnny the actual human being. And there's so much more nuance in this book that's ever been published before, and that really impacted me, and I hope it impacts readers as well and gives them a fuller view not only of Johnny the man, but an appreciation of Johnny's work and how he did what he did, because there's really nobody better than Bill Zamy at dissecting that stuff.
And I especially appreciated the information. I didn't know a lot about the early years in television, both locally and then when he first emerged on the national scene. And one of the most powerful stories in the book is his military experience on the USS Pennsylvania.
It is. You know, he was, I can't remember his rank off the top of my head, but he was there when there was an explosion on board, and he was part of this crew that actually pulled bodies out of the, I don't know if you call it the hatch or the cabin, and he never really talked about that. There was one instance I found, maybe two. His mother mentioned it once, you know, in an article to a magazine writer, but there were some real dark days in his military training. I mean, he would also, you know, do some entertaining while he was there, too. But I think that was, in many ways, a formative experience for him.
Well, it is a fascinating study of one of the most interesting people in the history of entertainment, and a wonderful job by both you and Bill pulling this all together. I think I've read every Carson book out there, but none of them compare to Carson the Magnificent. So congratulations to you, to Bill, and you've done a great job carrying on his legacy by making this all come to fruition.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so great to hear. I really appreciate it.
Mike Thomas with us here on Downtown. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thanks, Rich.
It is 24 minutes after the hour here.